Hi there, you're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi everybody, my name's Sue Nelson from the Food Talk Show and I'm joined by Guy Routledge. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Sue.
And Guy is Chief Executive of The Food Rush. You must check that out.
It sounds a bit fancy. I don't tend to call myself that.
Co-founder.
We'll go with that.
Yes, and also with Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. Hi, Ollie.
Hi, how's it going?
Yeah, good. You've got more research come out again, haven't you?
Where's always research?
You love it when there's
lots of data.
He loves his data, it's fantastic.
He
loves lots of data, yeah. Absolutely loves lots of data. We've got a great programme today. We're joined by Alessio Dantino, who's a good friend of mine, and he's famously late, and obviously he's not in the studio yet. That's typical Italian.
Fashionable.
He'll be here soon. And it is absolutely my pleasure to be joined by Monica Linton. And for those of you who don't know, Monica owns Brindisa, which I spend quite a huge proportion of my earned income in.
I thought you were going to say your time, but no.
And time.
Time, hopefully, and yes. Enjoying yourself.
Indeed.
Too.
And and we're going to learn all about that. Now, I'm used to Brindisa going to Borough Market, and you've got your tapas bar on the corner.
That's right.
So I've been in there a few times, although you can hardly get a seat most of the time.
Yeah, from day one it's been like
always healing. Yeah.
Yes, and my favourite bit is right at the back of Borough Market, and it's got everything Spanish, but really good. So would you like to know what I spend my money on, Monica?
Yeah, could you tell me? Is it the ham? Is it the oil?
It's the ham. Is my favourite. You do very good cheese in there as well.
Yeah.
I buy everything. I like you have Padron peppers in there.
Oh, that's right. The yeah. best.
Really good Padron peppers. Yeah. And you've got what's it called? The paprika.
Pimenton. Pimenton de la Vera.
Yeah. What's your personal favourite? What do you sneak off yourself? You know, what do you sort of cream off the top yourself? You know, and take home just for
it
taste.
Has to be
just for testing.
Cheese. I'm sorry, cheese. I have to go back to cheese. It always goes back to cheese for me. I mean, the cheese range we've been developing over the years, it's a challenge getting things across Spain and keeping them in the right condition all the way to Britain. We've built some cheese rooms at our Balham warehouse to help us look after the cheese a bit better. So we always have to try those. Quite often.
So I always think of Manchego cheese, but that's the sum total of my Spanish knowledge about cheese.
I was going to say exactly the same thing.
I know
thing.
Loads and loads and loads about English cheese.
I read somewhere you have something like 60 different cheeses that you import. And,
that's right.
And I was thinking,
yeah.
The only one I can name is Manchego.
Manchego, yeah. Well, because it's an indestructible cheese, it's travelled the world. Mm. It's not difficult to look after. It's got a flavour that everybody likes. There's lots of variations because you can mature it a bit more or a bit less. So, you know, that makes it pretty familiar to a lot of people, but there's a lot of other cheeses. I mean, lots of cheeses that we don't bring because it's just too many to try and convince the public here to buy. But we have 60 at the moment, and we could have more, but it's not necessarily the number of cheeses that makes the difference. It's choosing the right ones, looking after them well, making sure it's something that the British public do really want to buy, and it's not just there out of vanity. If you know what I mean.
Can you give us some examples of some of these new names? Because maybe I have heard of
tell
some.
Tell me what I should be ordering.
You've obviously brought samples, right?
Oh,
no.
Sorry. I could have done, actually. But I
don't
had my
say
kids.
That.
Yeah. No. Well, the ones that might be more familiar might be Mahon or Maon from Menorca, because a lot of English people do go to the Balearic Islands. So that's a cow's milk cheese that's rubbed in paprika. It's got an orange rind.
I have to say, actually, I've just come back from Menorca and I did have that.
Okay.
I
thought you were looking rather glowing this morning too.
Well, the rind is actually very aromatic, almost smells of peaches. The olive oil and paprika on the outside of the cheese, and then the cheese inside is just to die for, particularly if you get a really creamy one, not one that's too dry. Mm.
And there's a lot of people around Menorca who are making their own little cheese now.
Absolutely.
It's becoming a little bit of a mini industry, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. There's they're even making, actually, as the
Alessio,
Italian... As the
Italian just
yes,
arrived.
As you arrived, they're actually making a Menorcan mozzarella.
Oh.
That's
oh,
rather
very good.
That when we go there on holiday, we always eat. It's a very, it's a cow's milk one, but it's a very decent version of a mozzarella.
And do the Spanish do a sort of blue cheese at all?
They do quite a lot, but they tend to be from the same region. So the Picos de Europa Mountains, which cross Cantabria, Asturias, and León in terms of provinces.
My Spanish geography is not what it should
those,
be.
All of those provinces have blue cheesemakers in them, and they have mountain caves where they get, communal caves where they get put. So you've got Gamonedo, you've got Cabrales, you've got Tresviso, you've got Picos de Europa. So you've got at least four, and there's more coming out, and La Peral, it's five. There's more coming out all the time because quite a lot of people are moving back to the countryside in Spain and creating either new cheeses or bringing back old cheeses. So that's really a really interesting. Some of them are very, very strong. So, you know, you have to be warned or eat them at the end of your selection because otherwise you can't taste
it. And I guess you have to pair them with the right kind of thing that you've had previously. Otherwise it could completely destroy the flavours of, you know, the rest of the meal or anything you might have after.
Exactly. But I mean, in a way, we should know that from putting port with Stilton here. Port's quite a sweet wine. So in a way, red wine fights with blue cheese. But if you have a sweet wine, be it port, be it Pedro PX.
Or the Pedro Jimenez sherry is incredible.
Yeah, exactly. Or Madeira or Muscadel. Any of those sweet wines with a blue cheese to die for. And then if you pair it with prunes or sweet sugar, you know, sweet fruits like that.
Oh, getting hungry.
It is really, really good. Roquefort and prunes. You know, Spanish Cabrales and prunes is just an amazing combination.
Ollie, any thoughts on Spanish cheese from you?
No, I mean, I think what's interesting about Spanish food more generally is that I sort of feel that Brindisi has been a bit of a lone voice in trying to champion a greater understanding of Spanish food. And it's I don't think it's taken off as much here as it could have done, in the sense that, we're relatively food literate as a team, and yet we don't know that many Spanish cheeses. And why do you think it is that there hasn't been, do you disagree with that?
I don't disagree with that.
Before you answer that, I actually think Spanish food, I know this is, I'll probably get loads of tweets now or whatever, but I really do think Spanish food is better than French food, is my personal opinion. I know it's a massive generalisation, but when I go into the countryside in Spain, I'm always stunned by the food. Stunned. But it, as Ollie said, it doesn't seem to translate when you come over to the UK.
Well, I think some of it is quite difficult to translate. I mean, in a way, the Spanish have got two ingredients that are the basis for a lot of their meals, and they're quite difficult to handle. I mean, rice, Spanish rice is quite difficult to cook well, and legumes, dry beans. Not everybody's got the time to think about preparing bean dishes in England. We've got baked beans in a tin, and that's about, you know, the best you get in a way. Whereas Spain, in fact, like in Italy and in France, beans do comprise quite a big part of the menu.
Of the diet,
And here we've got pasta, you throw a sauce on it, you know, do it quite badly probably. In most, in many sort of domestic situations, it's just a sauce from a supermarket and you throw it on top and you think it's all...
The taste of nothing. I don't know how they can do it.
Quite gloopy.
It's unbelievable.
So, I think that's partly why the Spanish cuisine hasn't travelled as far. And I also think some of the raw material, like the fish, the wild fish, some of the meat that you get in Spain in the plateaus of places like Avila, the beef, is unbelievable. But people wouldn't think of bringing it over, really, because we've got our own beef, for example. But when you go into inland Spain and you eat the milk-fed lamb, the suckling pig, the milk-fed goat, kid goat, that sort of meat is amazing. But again, it's quite subtle in flavour because it's a very young meat. So you wouldn't put mint sauce with it.
So
culturally, some of them don't work very easily here. So the audience is limited because unless you have it in situ, you don't necessarily see the combination.
In some ways, the one thing I think that has really landed here is the chorizo, which is sort of omnipresent. And in fact, when we did some research a while ago to sort of say to people, you know, what are they, you know, this is a foodie audience to say, what are you cooking? One of the things that came up was something which our audience described as chorizo stew, which one of our team members, who's Catalan, said is not a dish, which I thought was quite amusing. But, you know, I think chorizo is the one thing that really has captured the imagination of the cooking British public.
But most of it is rubbish, though. I mean, the great thing about if you go to Brindisi, you can ask and they will tell you, because there's lots of different types
of
chorizo.
Absolutely. We have about 8 or 10 different chorizos.
Because you've got a lovely cooking chorizo.
The cooking chorizo is fantastic. It's even sold in my fishmonger, which is very helpful.
Because it does pair with certain things well. But a chorizo is, I think for the Spanish, it's probably not an ingredient in the same way it is for the British or for external markets. It's something that you eat for a picnic, something that you eat when it's convenient. You know, you eat it maybe in a bit of a hurry. You do make a bean stew with it. They ideally would pair it with legumes, which we don't like cooking that much. I mean, not in my household, we cook them a lot, but generally pulses and chorizo are fantastic because it's a very fatty sausage. So yes, you need something that's going to soak it up.
It leaks out. You shouldn't, it's gorgeous.
You should put it with bread, really nice with sandwiches, or a hot chorizo or a slice. So bread and legumes are the two things that they would use. But of course here we use it with pasta, we use it with rice, we put it with anything.
Because it just tastes great.
Yeah, because people love it. It's a fast sort of quick flavour, isn't it? You can grab hold of it, and we love spices.
Exactly.
Alessio, hello. You've arrived fashionably Italianly late. Hello.
Looking fashionable as well.
Yes, looking fashionable. He always does. He's so cool. Have you got an Italian chorizo equivalent that you can think of?
We do, actually. It's called salami, I guess, is the closest to...
But not the horrible Danish salami that you'd find sliced. This is completely different.
No, yeah. I guess it's cured meat that is aged as well. So that, I guess, is the closest thing to chorizo.
Or indugia.
Or
indugia is quite... Yeah. And that fresh...
That's fresh and is very spicy as well.
Yeah. I've just come back from Italy, and indugia sausage, you know, in pasta.
Can get a little hot, I guess.
Yeah. I found an indugia spread the other day.
Yeah.
I think indugia has a relationship with the sobreasada of Mallorca and Menorca, which is also a soft cured sausage, but it's got similar ingredients to a chorizo, like indugia has. Sometimes it's hot, often not as hot as the indugia, but it's... I believe, my feeling is that the indugia and the sobreasada are shared by Italy more than sobreasada shares chorizo of the mainland, if absolutely. You see what I mean. But because chorizo has become so ubiquitous, people would add chorizo to a dish here when they really should be selecting a sobreasada, like you would choose an indugia.
Indugia, we actually have in Italy something called soppressata, which is very similar, I guess, to that one, that has no spices. So it's just a soft curated cheese.
Well, I mean, the Catalans occupied Sicily at least once.
Yeah, exactly.
So, gastronomically and historically, they share.
So Monica, I'm just going to ask you a little bit of your background, and then I'm going to talk about my favourite subject, which is Serrano ham.
Okay.
Because I do buy a lot.
We might have a bit of a fight with Parma ham at the other end of the table.
No. Well, no, maybe.
I came here in peace. It's a bit of a lay, but in peace.
Yeah. So Monica, just explain your background. How on earth did you get seduced by Spain, I guess, is what must have happened.
Yeah, I can't put my finger on it exactly, but I did choose to learn Spanish at school, partly because my father had always told me about his time travelling to Spain when he was a student on a motorbike from Chingford down to San Sebastian on a sort of mobilette that, God knows how he did it, but that's what he did. He told us all the stories of camping out in barns and all that kind of thing, a bit like Midsummer, I Stepped Out One Midsummer Morn, that type of... story. So that really inspired me, because actually when we were at school, it's not that usual for Spanish to be chosen or to be taught, but in my school they did offer it against German, and although my mum's family are German, I chose the Spanish because it was a little bit more, I don't know, sunshine.
Sexy.
More sunshine.
Sexy, actually, isn't it?
Yeah. So that enabled me also to travel to South America, and then when I came back and finished my degree and so on, I lived in Spain to really consolidate my Spanish, and then I just thought, back in London, what am I going to do? I could teach, I tried Amnesty International, all sorts of, you know, charity type of organisations. And in the end, set Brindisa up, because I didn't find the job I wanted. And so we set up Brindisa because that was definitely going to get me in touch with Spain.
And this was 1988? It's quite a time ago, really.
Sort of 86, 87, 88, building up. And then we incorporated Brindisa in 88. And my mission with Brindisa, obviously, apart from creating jobs in the city and so on, was to also support small producers across Spain and try and get the rural economy in Spain to be able to find something outside, beyond their borders, because they'd had a very isolated time with the Franco dictatorship. And so this was a sort of a mission that I wanted to try and complete. And
So that means for business expenses, you just trot over to Spain and go and find and taste stuff and then come back and bring it with you. That's quite a good business model, isn't it?
Yeah, no, the suitcase, I always check in a suitcase.
I'm sure.
A hand luggage isn't enough.
I'm sure there's some hidden compartments in it as well. Yeah. Make sure you bring in contraband sausages.
Yeah. Luckily, we don't have to do that. But
Anymore.
So it has been done.
So it was 1988 and that started taking off. So what did you do? Just sell it? How did you start off selling?
Cold calling, knocking on doors. You know, it's a combination of one, I think speaking Spanish was a huge advantage. I could ring up Spanish suppliers in rural villages and say, I'd like this, could you explain, you know, price, how you get it to me? So they were up for it. And then trying to sell it to the customers here, I think partly because I spoke Spanish, could pronounce the names and all of that. And I could give them confidence.
Authentic.
Yeah. So all the big food halls, you know, Selfridges, Fortnum's were two of our first customers. They've been customers ever since. Then the top chefs of that time, which you imagine the early 90s, there was Alistair Little, absolutely groundbreaking. Rowley Lee, Mark Hicks, Simon Hopkinson at Bibendum, Pierre Kaufman, and they would buy things. Although some of their cuisines might not have been very Spanish, they would buy key ingredients because the quality was exceptional, be it the anchovies, be it the pulses. And then the other things, if they couldn't put it on the menu, they'd buy it anyway and just take it home, eat it at home with their families, because they really appreciated the flavours. So it was hard work.
And it's interesting because Great British Chefs, essentially, you've got a whole number of, you know, famous celebrity chefs.
Yeah, people like Pierre.
And so you've got this, you know, 2017 version of this. How important is it for consumers to feel that famous chefs or people who are really at the top of their game are using particular ingredients? Does that influence? So would that have helped Monica's business by having that?
I think if you look at the way that consumers find recipes, one of the things that always comes top of the list is, where did you find the recipe? It's like, I was inspired by it on holiday. So if you visit a place, you will then use that moment to try and come home and recreate it. And you know, we've all done that. And I think what's really changed over the last sort of 10, 15 years is you now can find those ingredients more broadly. It is beyond the Selfridges and the Harrods of this world. You can find specialist retailers that are selling this kind of stuff. So I think certainly, you know, travel inspires people to try and create dishes. But I also think, you know, going to restaurants, you know, so Jose Pizarro, you know, one of the kind of, you know, really kind of, I think, done a lot in terms of, you know, really raising the profile in the chef community of Spanish cooking. People like that will help raise it further and further and further. But interesting, I don't think in this country we have enough big Spanish chefs who are really kind of leading the way.
Because Barrafina is one of my favourites,
absolutely.
For example. And even when I go in there, that your stuff's in there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've been in the trade since 1988. So we're going to be 30 years old in January.
Wow.
So we've been supplying professional chefs all that time. And so they can distinguish they don't have to buy it just because it's Spanish. They need to buy it because it's immensely good quality.
And do you think then that Ollie's point that you know, people were going to Spain and travelling, you know, in the 80s and 90s, weren't they, on their sort of package holidays? Do you think travel did inspire people to try and search out? You know, did you hit the timing pretty well, do you think?
Well, I think yes, because when I started, Spain wasn't in the EU. So over these last 30 years, Spain has become more and more familiar and accessible to people beyond the beach holiday. So that has really, really, really helped. And I do think that because in the early first 20 years or so of Brindisa, before we had the shop in Barra, before people such as Pizarro and Nieves worked with us as customers and as also with Pizarro as a business partner at the beginning, you know, they managed to bring even more credibility to the whole agenda. Because previous to that, it was mainly British chefs buying Spanish ingredients and then amalgamating them within their menu, which was very, very, it was fantastic. But I think having some now higher profile chefs, even though they're not the Michelin, you know, the very high profile from Spain, like Adrián, Santi Santa Maria and all those kind of people, that level hasn't really hit London yet or been successful or very, very popular yet. These, you know, Nieves and Pizarro and have really helped.
But it's quite London-centric, and which is quite interesting, which is when you get out into the Manchesters and the Birminghams of this world, a lot of the other international cuisine, I think, has cascaded more widely. And actually, I think Spanish food is still quite ghettoized, actually, in certain parts, actually in parts of London, weirdly in South London. That's sort of where it feels like it's heritage.
And do you think, you know, you were talking about, El Bulli, you know, coming at the top of, you know, the world's best restaurants consistently. Do you think that's helped Spain get you know, people going,
the world's best
restaurants in Spain?
I think
it's not in New York, it's not in London.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think when I started Brindisa in 88, you know, Spain really wasn't particularly fashionable or well known or popular beyond the basic, obvious beach holiday. So I don't think people knew that many about Spanish artists, Spanish design labels, Spanish chefs. All of that was emerging. And so I think Ferran and all the crowd of amazing chefs in Spain have really added recognition to the quality of Spanish ingredients. They've added a whole lot of interest on the regionality of Spain. You've got amazing chefs in even the Canary Islands. Some of the food I've had there is to die for, but the majority of people who go to the Canaries wouldn't even know.
We'll have hamburger and chips, which is so disappointing.
So I think that's it is a huge and brilliant combination.
Now, I know, Guy, you've just come back from a little weekend.
It was a few weeks ago, the most amazing food.
Didn't
we were in San Sebastian, and it was like a foodie mecca, probably the best way to describe it. It was incredible. You've got this tiny little, they call it the Old Town, and there's all these beautiful, beautiful buildings. You could just, if you weren't so hungry and the food was so amazing, you could just walk around for, for hours just looking at the architecture. It's incredible. And you go to all these little bars. It's kind of a different flavour on tapas. So it's they call it pinchos, and a lot of the food is served on bread rather than just on a small plate. But that way of eating is just absolutely incredible. And it seems that even though the Spanish cuisine hasn't necessarily caught on as much in the UK as it could have done, that idea of eating many small plates of food has kind of extended to other cuisines now, which is interesting.
I mean, my favourite is in Seville, right by the cathedral, and I went in and it was like, I can't remember, €1 for every dish. Hadn't got a clue what these things were.
Spanish isn't
too bad, but, you know, in terms of food, you know, on a menu. And it was packed, this place, and there weren't any seats, and people were ordering tapas, and then, you know, somebody at the bar would then hold and pass along to you, because no way you were going to get to the bar. Passing bits of food.
We had
and
a
it was
similar
very,
experience.
Very, very community orientated.
We went to this place called, I think they call it The Butcher, and they serve all sorts of amazing things. We had a pig's ear, we had this octopus, which was incredible, and some beef cheeks. But it was, I even have a photo of it on my phone. It was like a packed tube station at rush hour, peak rush hour, and, you know, nobody could get in, nobody could get out, but it was just this real camaraderie of people eating and enjoying.
And the floor's a complete mess, isn't it, Monica? Funnily enough,
when we first we were looking at the site in Borough Market, we were wondering, could we bring that culture of how you offer that kind of customer service where you don't charge people as you give them food, you just trust them all to kind of tell you how many they had before they leave the restaurant. And we thought maybe that wouldn't work here, but we did think about it because that is all part of that culture. Not being able to book, crowding in to a space is absolutely part of it. And when we opened the Borough Market Tapas Brindisa, that was how we ran it. We got quite criticised at the time, and quite a lot of the press and customers say, oh, you can't book, we can't go, that's not right. But I said, well, that's what a tapas bar is all about. It's just crowding in and fighting your way
that,
a bit.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. But
it was funny.
Now it's the norm.
Yeah, you take padella, which is one of the neighbours, you know, that's the way everyone does it.
Yeah, so we had queues from day one because of that.
Amazing.
But, you know, that was back in 2004. It wasn't the norm at that point.
Yeah, it's very different to the way that we tend to go to a restaurant and expect to sit down and you have the ceremony and all that kind of stuff. But this is... It's kind of organized chaos, but it's amazing.
Yeah. It's absolutely perfect.
And once you get used to it feels like a more natural way of eating. Mm. But I guess here, because it's so different to what we're used to, it takes a bit of getting used to.
Mm. Yeah, it does.
So can I go on to my favourite topic now?
Yes, of course.
So if I walk into Brindisa in Borough Market, you'll have at least two or three, sometimes four, huge, what do you call them? Legs of ham. And you've got these guys carving them, as always. And my favourite, of course, is the most expensive.
It has
the most wonderful maroon colour.
Yeah.
It's not pink or red at all. It's deep. And of course, that horrible white, flabby stuff, fatty stuff you get in the supermarket is just not there. It's creamy and it's yellow. And when you taste it, it is so unctuous. It makes my mouth water now, but it actually makes your mouth water. It's not dry, is it?
No. I mean, it's a different... there's so many things that are different about that ham that make it all the things that you
enjoy. So can you explain what this ham is and how it's cured and looked after?
Well, it is a different breed. So it's an Iberico pig, and Iberico pig is quite a fit, fast-running animal. And he lives in the wild, so it really does live in the wild. They have about 10 hectares or more per head. So it's more than anything you've ever really seen in Britain for any animal. Maybe lamb gets about that sort of space in Wales. But the pigs there, then, so for the first 2 years of their life, well, they're the first year of their life, they're just running wild through these hills. They are hills, so they have to go up and down. There's pools of water around the forest, so they can go and cool off in those pools of water. But they have to be able to move around. So they gorge under all the, there's about three different types of acorns that they eat, and they eat their favourite ones first, and then they eat the slightly more bitter ones at the end of the season. So from November to January, they're gorging on these different varieties of acorns. The acorns obviously have a property in terms of natural properties that allow, that get absorbed into the animal's fat, and that, because they're running around, is lubricated. It gets very streaked in its pattern.
It does actually have a slightly nutty taste as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Because the meat is streaked, or marbled, as they say, that's partly because they're also partly because they can absorb that the oil from the acorn very, very well. It infiltrates the meat and the fat very well. Because they're very fit, they run around, and so the fat lubricates the whole of the lean, so you get this marbling right through the meat.
You haven't brought any with you, have you? Because you didn't bring any cheese, and you haven't brought any ham either.
We'll have the only solution.
That's terrible,
isn't
it?
Come back.
Yeah. I can come back. That's easy.
We can do an on-air tasting of different types of.
Yeah. Please don't.
We can bring some supermarket stuff as well, just to see.
Yeah, yes. And I could have brought the cheese with the most unpronounceable name, Idiasabal, which I do have at home in my fridge. Oh. But I'm very sorry. Next time. Okay. Invite me again. I'll bring a platter.
I think this was a tactical decision, so she has to come back.
So you have a plate of serrano ham. It's important, isn't it, to take it out of the fridge about 20 minutes before you serve it, because you don't want it ice cold, do you? You can't taste it.
No, ham, and particularly if you buy a ham on the bone, so the serrano ham, ham on serrano, is usually a white pig, crossbreed white pig, that is cured in normal chambers. It's distinguishing between one and the other is always a job, in that the ones with an origin like Treveles from Andalusia would be a better serrano ham than maybe another one. And then the Iberico ones, which are the ones that you like, which are the acorn fed ones. If you buy a whole one, you really should never put it in the fridge. Because
I can't afford a whole one.
I get a little pack
of slices that your guys carve off.
Then you have to definitely take those out of the fridge. Probably 2 hours before. Depends a bit on the season. Okay. But I mean, in the summer, 2 hours is fine. In the winter, I take it out first thing in the morning.
How long would a leg last? If you actually... sat it there. So I'm sure, assuming at Christmas, you take home one leg and it sits... and pride of place in your kitchen.
Yeah, if my nephew's there to carve it. Yeah. I'm not very good at carving. Right.
There is
not
a special like the boys, way, isn't
but,
there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a serious skill. You do, and it requires practice.
Don't you teach courses on it as well?
Yeah, we teach courses on it. Yeah.
Got to sign myself up for some of those. Me too. I'll bring you some ham,
Me too.
How long?
We get through them. We like to get through them in a week. Right. In the business.
That would be difficult.
So at home. That's quite difficult, unless it is Christmas and you're really busy.
And you're really
Christmas.
Focused.
I mean, I think it can last up to 2-3 weeks, but you need to keep it downstairs or somewhere in a cellar. And if you haven't got a cellar, somewhere cool.
And put a tea towel over it.
Put a tea towel over it.
Nowhere
near a dog. You need to make sure that the cut surfaces are well moisturised with the fat. So you don't throw away the fat that you cut off the top. You then sort of moisturise the open bits and then pack that all on so that it doesn't dry out. Because that's heartbreaking, obviously.
And what would you serve it with? Somebody told me that actually serving it with champagne is one of the best options for a little bit of
parmesan. You do like the finer things.
Champagne goes well with fatty things.
Budget's going up.
Or Prosecco or Cava or whatever.
Yeah.
But also sometimes I serve it with a little bit of parmesan cheese over the top or whatever the Spanish
I think you've just insulted her. I mean, that was like the one where you should not have said that.
I am so glad we're on the radio. I've just got the worst.
That was a serious
stare. Sorry,
that was
a death stare. That was. Like,
how is it if you put on your popcorn on your cereal?
I'll tell you what.
Figs.
You need sweet things.
Changing the subject
really.
Quickly.
But actually, if you did want to put cheese, it's better with the smoked beef. A bit like in the bresaola you get from Italy. In Spain, they've got something called cecina, and that's really good with cheese. But it's with the ham, no.
Or sometimes I just have
figs, grapes, sweet, fruity things are good. Tomatoes, nice tomatoes.
Melon
would be very nice. Mm. Yeah, I think you
just
need fruit.
Just by itself.
And just by itself is very cool.
And so my top tip here today is if you're not a chef and you're not very good at cooking, and you've got people coming around, go and get some of this stuff. I mean, for £15, you can get a huge amount of this stuff. It's actually gorgeous. Lay it on a plate. everybody is dipping with their fingers. They will love you for it. You do not have to be an amazing cook to produce something.
But
like
I think this is, if we look at what we see amongst what foodies do in terms of the sort of the modern dinner party. The modern dinner party nowadays is it starts round the island in the kitchen, and people are there and they've got, you know, a plate of
nibbles,
ham, and they've got nibbles, and they've got all sorts, some stuff they've made, some stuff they bought, and actually whoever is cooking is sort of doing their performance cooking while chatting away, and there's stuff there, and actually it means you're cooking, you know, your dessert and your main, but actually the first course is a sort of grazing moment, and that's what I think where hams like that come in.
Well, that's the poshest, greatest moment you can get, isn't
it's great,
it?
Isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Standing around
I mean,
the
that
island.
Is what I try and say in when we speak to customers, and I put in the book that you know, don't try and attempt to cook a full tapas menu at home. Mm. You'll be there forever, and then people will eat them in a second, and it'll be like, oh my God, it's
where's
all
the
gone.
Next one?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you're doing it at home, you know, have the hams, have the tinned fish, have the cheeses, have some padron peppers.
Amazing.
Those, you know, I mean, that. Why bother to do something more complicated at home? And that's partly why tapas bars exist in Spain, because most people in Spain would never attempt to cook croquetas and all that kind of stuff at home. It's very difficult to do. If you've got a team of chefs doing all the mise en place, that's great. If you're at home, it is quite hard
work. Well, thank you very much, Monica. We're going to come back to you later. We're going to have a little break, and I've got a little bit of a pre-record for you to listen to, and then we're going to be talking to Alessio about crowdfunding and all sorts of other things, what he's doing at the moment. So let's listen to this, and then we'll come back in a tick. I'm sitting opposite Henry Weston, who's 6'4", can barely fit into our radio pod at Food Matters Live. Anyway, we managed to wedge him in, and he's sitting opposite me. And Henry has started this company called the Protein Water Company. I've got three bottles in front of me, really great packaging. So we've got sort of very bright yellow, very bright orange, very bright pink. On the packaging, it says muscle maintenance. So Henry, what is muscle maintenance and what is your protein water that we have in front of us?
Well, protein water consists of 20 grams of whey protein isolate. It's different to your typical milk-derived drinks. It's very clean, it's very refreshing, and it's all natural as well. There's nothing artificial in it. There's no artificial preservatives, sweeteners, and there's only 5 grams of fructose per drink, so that equates to probably 1 teaspoon of sugar, you know, similar to what you put in your coffee. So, yes, we got 20 grams of protein, it's whey protein isolate, that's derived from milk.
And essentially what you're doing this, you're doing it for sports people or for people who are working out and really controlling, you know, what they're having and having a really good water drink that's got the other stuff that these guys are looking for.
Yeah, it's a great workout drink. You could take it in and around the workout, but it's also a great convenience drink you can pick up on the go. And with the very low sugar, you can drink at any time of the day. So you're not having that extra added guilt of taking extra sugar, but you're still getting that clean protein source. You can take it, you know, it's great to take with meals as well because it's not very filling, but it does give you that. It does fill you up at the same time.
So we've got some really interesting flavours. I've got grapefruit and yuzu. I'm afraid I don't even know what yuzu is.
Well, yuzu is a Japanese citrus fruit. It's very similar. It's a mixture of between orange and a lemon, if we were to compare it. So it's like, and it's very tangy. And
so that looks very tangy, grapefruit and yuzu. And then I've got coconut and mango, and the other one is raspberry and cranberry. Do you want, can Lucy have a little taste of one? Okay, so, oh, we've got some little glasses here. Lucy, tell me, this is for muscle maintenance. I expect your muscles to be, you know, bulging after this one.
Well,
what are you going to go
my
for?
My muscles do need a lot of maintenance. So yeah. I'm going to try the grapefruit and yuzu because I really like citrus and sharp.
It's really refreshing. This one's good after the workout because it's really thirst quenching. It's really refreshing.
Oh. And it's slightly cloudy. Lemonade-y colour.
Yeah, looks like a nice fresh lemonade. Oh, that's really nice. It's really sharp.
Yeah.
But it's not so you shudder or anything like that. And it's got just the right sweetness.
Yeah. Tried to make it not too sweet, but we tried to keep it as low as sugar as possible, but you do need some fructose in it to give it that sort of rounded flavour to it.
Would you like to try something?
No, I'm going to try coconut and mango, as you've tried that one.
That could be my drink. Where can I buy this from?
So it's being listed in Whole Food Market as of next month. It's also available on our website and a few independents around the UK as well.
And just shout out your website for us. So if anybody's into this thing and, you know, and really like the sound of Henry's product, this is where they need to go.
So it's www.proteinwater.co. That's .co, not .com or .co UK.
Proteinwater.co. So I'm going to try the coconut and mango, which is slightly orangey in colour.
All natural colours as well. We use a mixture of safflower extract, red carrot extract, red grape, cherry concentrates.
And has it taken you a long time to get this balance right, and also to get the ingredients right? Because you can in your head you can say, right, I want a little bit of protein and I want this and I want whey, and then all of a sudden you put it together and it tastes disgusting, and then you've got to start balancing all those things until you get it right.
It's been extremely difficult. It's taken about a year to get the flavour right, and it's only up to probably 2 weeks ago we did this second production run that I've been actually really happy with this final product. Trying to have the drink that's natural and low sugar, but with that 20 grams of protein, it's extremely difficult. So I'm really, really pleased with how they taste now. You know,
very good. Well, you've got your last one here. So you've got raspberry and cranberry. What are you thinking, Lucy?
I really like that one as well, I think.
That's your favourite.
I don't know. The grapefruit and yuzu still is
all very consistent. They're all good.
Yeah,
consistent,
exactly. What I find with the two that I've tried, I don't know if you find the same with the strawberry one, is you don't taste any artificial flavours. It's all actual. Like, I feel like I've just had a punnet of raspberries and cranberries, and the same with the grapefruit as well. It tastes real, basically.
Yeah. With a lot of these protein drinks and waters, you'll get a chalky aftertaste as well. We've managed to mask that as well, which has been another challenge we've had. So, yeah, no, it's great. All three are great tasting.
So there you go, proteinwater.co. Check it out, and well done, Henry. Good. And there we go. That was good stuff, wasn't it? So we're back in the studio again. We're with Guy Routledge of Food Rush and Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs and me, Sue Nelson. I'm looking at Alessio Dantino, who, as usual, has got the biggest beaming smile ever, which is his trademark. And, of course, we're joined by Monica from Brindisa. Hi, Alessio. How are you?
Hi, Sue. Very good, thank
you. Good, good, good. Now, we're going to talk about crowdfunding. Yep. And your specialism is crowdfunding in food. So yep. You have this website called Crowdfooding.
Yes, that's right. Is correct.
.co.uk.
And I know you're moving on to other things as well.
Yes.
And for those listeners who don't really understand what crowdfunding is, I'm going to say crowdfunding.
It's a great name, isn't it?
Yeah. there's two sorts of crowdfunding, isn't there? There's one where you know, generally, it's all internet-based, but generally you're taking equity. So you'll give somebody some money for their amazing company and you take a slice of it.
Yep.
So a percentage share. And more there's crowdfunding sites where people will take, literally it's a loan. So they will give some money and they will be given 5%, 10%, whatever it is. And that loan generally, the percentage rates generally vary depending on how risky the business is. So if it's seen as a newbie and quite risky, sometimes the return is 10%. If it's less, you know, it's 2 or 3%. Bearing in mind a lot of people are only getting 0.0004% from the bank at the moment. People are quite interested. Have I got the hang of that? Is that how it works?
Yes, that's how it works. There are actually even more actually models around crowdfunding. I would say the most basic one is what is called, it's called reward-based crowdfunding, and basically allows backers to get products or services from a company or from a project before everybody else will do. So you're basically financing their first batch of production, or, you know.
So what I could do is I could go to Brindisa and I could say, like, if I give you a sort of, I don't know, a loan of 10 grand, can I have as much of that Serrano ham as possible?
I think that's just called commerce, isn't it? So?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, actually,
it's called a bond, isn't it?
It's called bond, yeah. So depending,
it'd end up cheaper for me, actually.
I think actually, yes, for restaurants, there are different models, and I would say that the most suitable one are definitely reward-based crowdfunding and the peer-to-peer lending, as well as the equity crowdfunding bit. Even though I think for restaurants, again, creating a strong engagement with their customers is really important. So I think the reward model and the peer-to-peer lending is probably the most suitable. I think everybody... as or most of people, I guess, have always dreamed of having, you know, their own little table within a restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. So that's part of the rewards that actually, you know, restaurateurs could offer to their backers in exchange of maybe, you know, cash flows or even, you know, funding that will basically finance a specific bit of the business. And that's, again, where I think the engagement becomes so higher than, you know, just selling, if you will.
Because me and Ollie have got a bit of a problem with crowdfunding, haven't we?
We do, really.
Do you want to voice your opinion in terms of... And I think what you're doing is interesting because actually you're evolving from that. And as you say, the reward model sounds a bit more applicable to foodies, isn't it?
I think, you know, where I come at it from a sort of... Where I see the complexity is that people are making investments, and I'm talking here about where you put down, you know, £1,000 or £10,000 to invest in a business based on a valuation that generally bears no relationship to reality. And I think the most dangerous part of it is that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of businesses, and the government is actively encouraging this, to, you know, small person starts up an ice cream manufacturing business and they value the business at £5 million and they've just sold out the back of a truck. And the reality is if they get lucky, they might get that valuation, but only if they get lucky. And I think there is a crash waiting to happen in the crowdfunding industry. And there's some great ideas out there, but I think a lot of the valuations are crazy. And I did a bit of due diligence on it at one point. We were looking to use it as a platform. And the average multiple was just like completely off the charts. Oh, yeah.
So Alessi, I mean, if you go on these crowdfunding sites, and there are quite a few of them, aren't there?
Yeah.
So Cedars is one, and there's all sorts of others.
Crowdcube, Crowdfunder.
Loads and loads. And when you go on there, there might be, say, 20, you know, sort of little snapshots, case studies of these things. And some of them are apps, and some of them are, you know, all sorts of things going on there, some of them are products. And I look at some of those things, and I think, well, what is extraordinary about that? What is interesting? Mm-hmm. And yet people are asking for... literally hundreds of thousands of pounds for, let's say, a tiny percentage of the company, which is what Ollie's talking about, you know, and it automatically values it at £1 or 2 million. Now, I have my own company, you know, we've just reached £1 million turnover after 18 months and we're pretty proud of that. But actually, that's not ordinary. It isn't ordinary. And yet these people are saying that is what they're going to do in 6 months, which is just, it's just not real.
The math just doesn't add up, does it?
No.
I agree. So that's the reason why actually we kind of walked away in a way from that model. I see two big issues with equity crowdfunding, especially in food. The first one is the assumption that if I eat, I know what it means to make it to invest in food. And that's really, I think, what is really making this whole industry a little frothy, because, you know, a lot of people just throw money at things because they believe that, again, you know, they would understand the dynamics of this industry. And I'm sure you as a restaurateur, you know, when it comes to explaining to investors or any stakeholder for that matter, how hard it is also to run, you know, a food business. It boils down to, you know, margins, to taxes on exports, imports, and, you know, all this kind of dynamics, which, again, if an investor doesn't have an understanding of it, I think is really like blind investing, right?
Yeah,
so complex.
And this is one element. The other element, as Ollie mentioned, is actually the tax reliefs attached to these investments. I believe that there are, yes, great incentives to boost the economy, you know, and boost the startup, you know, community. But at the same time, I think not having any sort of barrier to entry into these, you know, sort of investments, I think it's a bit dangerous, because over time it will basically, you know, create a bubble that eventually will burst.
In terms of incentives, you're talking about the Enterprise Investment Scheme, so EIS.
Yeah. EIS and SEIS.
And SEIS is if you're a brand new company. That's a slightly different government scheme.
Yeah.
And for anybody that's not aware, what that means is that you can put in quite a big chunk as an investor, you get the most amazing tax benefits. And there are a lot of people who do this serially because they're getting 30-50%, you know, tax benefit that they wouldn't normally. But that's quite an informed investor who really knows what they're doing. That's not a grandma going onto crowdfundings because they like this ice cream.
Are they just doing it because they want some tax back because they've made a load of money and they want to, you know, offset that rather than they're expecting to make a load of money from their investment?
Yes, a lot of them are cereal. And you have to have that money in for 3 years, I think, isn't it?
3 years.
Yes. Yeah.
But not much of that money has yet matured. I mean, the fact is the whole EIS SES scheme is still relatively new.
Yeah.
We don't really know what the impact has been. It's certainly pumped a lot of money into business like ours. I mean, ours is EIS funded. Mm-hmm. But the reality is it's complicated. I mean, when we looked at doing the crowdfunding model, I'm not going to say who it was with, but I was astounded by the lack of interest that the platform showed in doing any due diligence on our numbers or any of our data.
Absolutely.
And literally at the point where they're like, oh, you know, I haven't really read that, but just tell me roughly what you are again, was sort of the opening conversation to us being put on the platform. And I'm like,
as a new business person then, you can say, well, let's face it, we're quite mature business people, but a lot of people will say, right, it's a new business, I'm going to do... $500,000 the first year and $1.5 million the second year, and I'm going to do it at 25% profit, and nobody's testing that. And anyway, how can you? Because you're a new business.
Exactly. So there is a lack of due diligence on the one end. The other end, I think, valuation, to be honest, is art at this point.
It's
not a science at all. So to be honest, I think the problem is not with the valuation. The problem is with the understanding of what it means to invest in an early stage startup. Because I think it goes back, to the barriers that I was talking about. If there is no barrier to entry, then everybody really can invest without the understanding of the risk that they're taking, as well as what to expect from these investments. I think you have these beautiful risk warnings, which no one reads. And I think if you run a survey, a vast majority of people don't know that actually the money they are investing, the only way that they can get a return, or the return running that investment is either by the company selling the business to somebody else or going IPO, which again...
And how often does that happen?
Yeah, exactly.
Especially with new startups.
That's again, I think that the problem with that, I'm a big fan of incentivizing investment in startups. The problem is that also the fact that you get the tax relief in the first year, whereas the return will occur in probably, let's say, 3 to 5 in the most...
5 to 10.
5 to 10 in the most optimistic, scenario. And that's where I think, again, is making the market a little frothy. Because, it's this kind of time span in between where people are like, I think they're more intrigued by the tax relief that they get straight away more than, contributing to the success of the business in the long haul, which is eventually... the only way they're actually going to make money.
I mean, the other thing that Ollie and I were talking about before we came on the show is that a lot of people are leaving big jobs, they're in big corporates. I mean, you haven't, Monica, because you almost started your career doing Brindisi, right from the beginning almost.
Yeah, funnily enough, I was on the Enterprise Land Scheme, which was a very small scheme compared to these ones.
Absolutely. And a lot of guys are in big, good corporate jobs. And obviously they're very intelligent, they're very experienced in business, but their experience in big business and having all that backup behind them. Starting, looking at their profile and going, well, they've got a good CV there, they're a pretty good bet. I think I might, and it is a bet, shove some money in there for the crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean to say that translates into starting your own business, does it?
No, not at all, actually. I mean, the dynamics are completely different. I also come from the corporate world. I've worked for a couple of years for Diageo within their innovation department. Of course, again, having the understanding of the industry helps a lot in identifying, latent opportunities, connecting the dots in creative ways so that you can actually leverage also your connections, to spark up your start up your business. But again, the dynamics of, the corporate and the startups world are completely different. And that's actually where we sit in right now. And in the way our model has evolved over time is actually helping small startups to get connected to the right people that can help them scale up their business. And these are talking, most primarily with corporates and bigger organizations who are looking at innovating because that they need to do it, right? And that's what I also saw, that it was a little bit broken in my corporate years. The way they drive their innovation agenda, most corporates, it's hard for them. They're not set to innovate at a pace that is basically the same that consumers expect it to be. So the problem there, and that's what we're trying to do, is to bring the best of both worlds, right? Startups are very good at understanding the consumer's needs and creating prototype and, you know, validating the opportunity, if you will. Corporates are set to scale up this proof of concept, right? And so by bringing together the best of both worlds, we believe that also we can see an impact in what consumers eventually will have, right? Will have access to, right? Because in the end, I guess, especially in the UK, it boils down to convenience, right? Yep. I see a lot of these startups that are creating amazing innovations, and, you know, they really nailed, you know, what consumers want. But in the end, if they cannot basically make their products available in big retailers, then it's hard, you know, for
so what you're saying. So what you're saying exactly then is that you started off by trying to see how you could help small businesses get investors.
Yes,
because that's one way of scaling up.
Yep.
But actually, for you, that model hasn't quite worked. So what you've done is you've morphed a little bit, and you've looked at, I can see great corporate abilities here, distribution, marketing, you know, all those things, scaling up they're very good at. And I can see all these wonderful little startups who actually need connecting with these. And actually, it's a much better model if you can make your money or whatever it is you do by matchmaking these two so they can get benefits out of each other than just simply getting somebody to give these startups money. And that's where you've
gone
now. Is that right?
Yeah. So we understood that in the end, you know, by helping these startups raising funds, in the end, you're giving oxygen to these corporates, to these companies, right? You're helping them to get to the next level. But at the same time, unless you bring smart money, meaning people who do this professionally, and that's, again, boils down to my previous point of differentiating, right? The retail investors from the one who do it professionally, right? Mm. And you get, you know, these people on board who can actually open doors, because this is what, you know, investing in startup is all about. It's not about, you know, throwing money in, you know, expecting a return.
Well, it just get wasted, won't it? Let's face it.
To be
honest.
So we tried to make that model work, because we had our network of investors who have done multiple investment in the space. But then we realized that most of the companies that were approaching us were just too early for this. So that's why we introduced the reward model as a way to validate the market and create, again, engagement with their community and with their first customers, right? To then quickly evolve into matching them up with bigger organizations who can help them scale up, which could also entail investments, but it's just a bit of the whole spectrum.
Because the corporates can't innovate, in my personal opinion.
It's like turning an oil tanker.
You'll have the most amazing people inside corporates, but often they're not allowed to do what they want to do because it might be too risky or it doesn't fit the brand.
You're right.
And so many things get killed at birth, really, in corporates. Yeah. And I meet a lot of people in the innovation sectors of big corporates who are very frustrated because they can't get what they want. So this is a great, because it's just as many problems there as it is for a small business, isn't it? But it's different problems.
Totally. Mm. And one, actually, of the biggest problem that we see is actually the capacity of taking these collaborations forward or turning these opportunities into real business cases, right? Mm. Again, the startups are small or fast, you know, fast moving. Corporates, again, they have, you know, they're all about operations and about, you know,
processes.
Yeah. So that's where we see also the biggest need for collaboration, for enabling actually this collaboration, because they just speak two different languages. Yeah. You know, corporates are set to achieve results and you know, specific things.
I think there's quite an interesting tension though that's emerging as well, though, because fundamentally I'm ex-Unilever, so I did 10 years at Unilever, and I think what Unilever and those businesses want are these massive global brands that basically run across the world. And a lot of the brands that come, food brands that come out of platforms, crowdfunding platforms, are probably never going to leave the UK, and actually that's quite an important set of brands, and I'm not sure where those brands fit within the portfolios of the big businesses like Unilever or other food businesses. So I think it's kind of a weird tension, which is actually most of these ideas are too small for those big businesses, but they are interesting. But, you know, I mean, so I think it's kind of a sort of a gap there, and I'm not quite sure how that's going to be filled.
But Ollie, what I find, though, is I think they are good at innovating in terms of, I mean, we see amazing things on this programme and also the Food Talk Awards, where we're seeing really good innovation in terms of product production innovation, let's call it that, you know, replacing meat or doing things in a different way, and I think it's not a brand. It's not a product where I think these small companies can really help corporates. It's doing something or a process very, very differently, which is, you know, it's the Pringles that change the crisp market. It's the, you know, whatever it might be. And I think that's where corporates should be looking, shouldn't it? Not just taking something and then saying, I'll add this to my brand portfolio, because I don't think that's going to work.
So I think it boils down to empowering entrepreneurs for two main reasons. The benefits I see is, first, as a corporate, you can actually play into categories that you will never, you know, enter yourself with, because it might be too costly, new product development, you know, maybe be an endless process, right? By empowering it, actually smaller organizations to do it and validate the opportunity for you, if you will. And the second and most, I think, important bit is that corporates are now not prepared to face innovation in the next 25 to 50 years. And the only way actually you can do it is by creating a contamination between your people and the entrepreneurs. Because I think it also boils down to drive, right? And I think, again, I had a small experience in the corporate world, but I was also frustrated by it, because I've seen that, you know, I couldn't do what I wanted, right? I was like, and Viaggio was an amazing place actually to work in, but still, I didn't have the drive that was putting me into positions to actually fight for it, if you will.
Yeah.
That is what, in the end, I think entrepreneurs, and I guess we have another example in the room here who started something.
Again, asking Monica, I'm terribly sorry we're running out of time.
No worries at all.
Really annoying, I have 4 or 5 minutes left. So, Monica, how do you keep innovating? Because what size are you now? You've got a couple of hundred employees now, haven't you?
Well, because it's two business structures. The, the restaurant employs 200 plus over across the 5 sites, and the warehouse and the 2 shops that we've got employs about 120. So it's quite a large
big
number. We started with, you know, 2, me and my brother, and, and about £1,500. So, you know, it's gone quite a long way, but it's been slow. You know, we've done it steadily. And I think we have this conflict in our own business, in both the businesses, because, you know, lots of people would like us to set a Brindisi restaurant up across, you know, all sorts of towns and cities of Britain. But that would be... I struggle with that, because I think you would just lose the heart of the business, then get so diluted. Mm. You've got to then find skills across all those cities that are at the level that you
it's
want.
It's not going to be you anymore, is it?
You benchmark it somewhere. Yeah. And in order to actually complete the operations across the country, you have to lower the benchmark. And I'm not prepared to do that. And on the wholesale and retail side of the business, we have started innovating with product, because obviously buying from the heart of Spain is the core business. But there's nothing wrong with actually converting a few products into a Brindisi brand, because we've got, you know, we're cooking every day for the British here in London. Not everything has to come from, you know, the mainland of Spain. So that's something that we've done. But it, culturally, it's a bit of a, we have to sit there and ask ourselves quite often, should we be putting Brindisi's name on something these very traditional tortas from Sevilla, the olive oil tortas, for example, or the Santiago tart from Galicia. But sometimes the packaging is inadequate in Spain. Sometimes the portion size is wrong. So you have to, you're forced to enable to get the sales. Then you want to do that. But it is, we do have to question all the time our DNA.
So to
is
recap,
that in line?
You're gonna keep it small and well, relatively, but you know, and grow it slowly in the way that you want, because you want your standards, I guess, across everything, really. We're just about to conclude now, Alessio. Just one lesson, if you're looking for crowdfunding, what should you be thinking of? What should you be doing instead?
Okay.
Possibly. And literally, we have literally got 10 seconds.
All right. So I guess crowdfunding is a marketing exercise in the end. So I think when it comes to looking at the different options, I think the first question that an entrepreneur should ask himself is, am I structured to do this exercise well, meaning you need to build a team that can help you, and then, you know, all the rest is kind of details, in the sense that, I mean, depending on the stage of development, if you're very early stage, I would definitely advise to go reward-based crowdfunding. Is pre-selling, is creating, you know, engage community of customers, and then move on into finding the right people who can actually help you build the business,
as well as invest.
When you invest, when you actually have the right bargaining power to approach them. So I don't see any point actually as an early stage business to go and do equity crowdfunding straight away, because I believe that the chances of attracting the wrong investors are too high.
It's very high. I would say very high. Yeah, we've always said no, Brindisa.
Good for you, Monica. Don't let them in. Don't let them in. Okay, we've just got 1 minute to go. So I'd like to thank you very much, Alessio Dantino.
Thank you.
Crowdfooding. Some great tips there, I think. And very interesting to see the model beginning to change. Mm. Monica, it's very good of you to come today. We know the problems of this week right outside your restaurant. So really, really appreciate you and Borough Market coming literally the next day.
Thank you.
And we're so pleased that all of your staff and your customers are safe. So thank you very much.
They've been very brave. Thank you. And
again, Guy Routledge, thank you so much from the Food Rush for
joining us. Always a pleasure, Sue.
Yes, and Ollie Lloyd from the Great British
Chef. You're
welcome. If you want to hear anything or find out anything, especially about Brindisa or crowdfooding, go on to foodtalk.co.uk. And another great programme. And see you next week.